introduce today's topical currents, Thursday edition, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Welcome now to my longtime colleague, Dr. Paul George of Miami-Dade College and History Miami. Paul, usually we're geared up for the South Florida history quiz, but today we concentrate on an essential part of the area's history, the Miami River. In its present state, it's, what, 5.5 miles and connects to the Miami Canal, but it wasn't always that way, of course.
Right. It was a beautiful, pristine stream as late as the early 1900s. Of course, civilization as it is comes to Miami in 1896 with the railroad, and you begin to see great changes with the river at that point. But the big thing, of course, would be the Everglades drainage off of the river beginning in 1909, building a canal about 90 miles north of Lake Okeechobee. And the early part of that canal becomes what today is the second port of Miami.
Paul, why don't we talk about the recent discovery, more evidence of the Tequesta civilization along the shores of the Miami River. What does it signify, and what years are we talking about, and what have they just found?
Well, the Tequestas were around here at least 3,000 years, and they were really kind of entrenched at the mouth of the river naturally because it meets the bay and what have you. There was another large settlement in the northern part of Key Biscayne. And we have found, Bob Carr, of course, being the archaeologist, we have found additional Miami circles, but not quite as defined as the original one we found in 1998. And it just tells us, among other things, that there was a certain sophistication in terms of construction. The original Miami circle we found is perfectly circular, 38 feet, completely around. These others, and I haven't seen them, I've read a little bit about them and I've heard from archaeologists about them, are not quite as defined. They're on the north bank of the river. One of them is pretty close to the edge of the original shoreline, which incidentally came as far east as what today would be a little bit west of Met 1. So if you look at the land from Met 1 to the bay, Met 1 would be at Biscayne Boulevard.
Oh, okay.
And about 3rd. If you look at the land for the next two blocks moving east of the bay, that's all fill, going back to the 1920s, early 1920s. So what Bob's digs have, I think, indicated to us over the last many years, he's been digging on the north bank since about 2002, is that a lot more Tequestas lived in that area than we previously thought, and that the concentration of Tequestas, especially on the north bank, was much larger than we had earlier thought.
Paul George has compiled along the Miami River with many vintage photos and text, Paul. For those who'd like to see it, how do they get a copy?
Well, History of Miami's bookstore has it, and I'm doing a tour of the Miami River this Saturday, and I believe they'll be selling, and I'll sign some of the books on the tour.
So people want to go out with you on Saturday, and I've done that. It's a great great experience. How do they get in touch with you?
Well, they would call History of Miami Susan Johnson at 305-375-1621. And she would be happy to help them book the tour.
And also, Paul's having a lecture and book signing exclusively Saturday, May 18th at History Miami.
I am. That should be a lot of fun, too. We're going to look at images of the river. I'm going to talk about the river. And, of course, there'll be books there, too.
Tell me, considering the river, what were the original water sources? Well, they were springs in the Everglades, but there were also springs within the river?
There were springs within the river. And there was a runoff from the Everglades into both the North and South Forks. The North Fork began as you're moving east around today's maybe 33rd Avenue and about a little bit south of the canal. So that would be equivalent to, it's Northwest South River Drive, equivalent to maybe 15th Street. The South Fork began moving east now, a little bit west of today's 27th Avenue at about Northwest 11th Street. And so you had that runoff, especially during rainy season, into the river. There was the falls. It would drop, and then it would move east. But you also had springs in the riverbed itself.
Tell us about the rapids. There were originally rapids on the river.
There were rapids in the river, especially on the North Fork. And what happened was, and that water's running off at about today's 33rd Avenue, it's dropping from the Everglades into this recessed area. It moves east, and then there was like a little stream, an artery that moved north from there, and there were these large rocks or boulders at the floor. It's a shallow floor, and that water coming down in the falls would hit this with a swirl, and it just kind of powered the water. And in fact, a couple guys who were grinding the root of a cycad tree. Today we would call it arrowroot starch. They use that water power at the rapids to power the machinery to grind that starch, the root of the cycad.
And when did they disappear? What happened?
Well, drainage really created their disappearance. The Everglades from the Miami River begins to be drained in 1909. And the drainage process is finished in 1913. It actually began Everglades drainage off the New River in Fort Lauderdale in 1906, off of the South Fork of the New River. And that led to a dropping of the water table. And that would lead to less of this motion, this action, this swirl around those boulders that created the rapids.
Okay. Tell us more about the history, in a thumbnail, say, of the Brickles.
Well, the Brickles are an interesting family. They came down here led by Bill Brickle, who came down with Julia Tuttle's father, Ephraim Sturtevant, and a man named Tom Thorpe in the early part of 1871. And they started homesteading, which is a legal title also for picking up land, but also buying land on the south bank of the river. At the same time, they opened an Indian trading post near the mouth of the river on the south bank. And so they had this Indian trade going on for about three decades, up until the beginning of the 1900s. Meantime, they owned almost all the land south of the river, along the bay, inland as far as the roads, inland as far as Little Havana, all the way over to what would be the north, to the south bank of the river as it's moving west past the Orange Bowl site. So they had a tremendous amount of land.
And Mary Brickle platted the roads area, correct?
Mary Brickle's idea. She died in January of 22, but her ideas for the roads or the ideas that took. That is, she wanted an area with a wide roads. She wanted a main street, which becomes Carl Way. She wanted everything planned very carefully. And the roads is one of the few center city neighborhoods I know anywhere in America that never went down in value after World War II with the flight to suburbia. It just kept going up. And during that last boom, its prices were almost as high as Coral Gables.
Because the streets are diagonal there, I always get kind of confused.
They're very confusing. Tell somebody you live on 9th Avenue and at the 2600 block. That'd be 26th Road across from St. Peter and Paul School. Nobody's going to know it.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Also, email radio@wlrn.org.
Paul, it's really hard to believe that as recently as 1895, there were 9 residents living in the wilderness around the Miami River.
9 people living on the Miami River, Julia Tuttle and her 2 children and the Brickles on the other side, and that was it. And that's based on the Florida State Census of that year. The next year, the railroad enters Miami, April of 1896, and you already have hundreds of people who are now beginning to lay out a city. And that city becomes a city officially on July 28, 1896, with incorporation.
I remember Marjorie Stoneman Douglas telling me when she first came to Miami that the road, which is now US 1, going from Miami to Coconut Grove, was a dirt road.
It would have been. In fact, it follows the right-of-way of the Florida East Coast Railway after it crossed the river in 1901.
Right.
What and where are these Indian caves you write about?
The Indian caves are really fascinating. I do about 50 or 60 different history tours. I've got to be a masochistic. And I just did what I call the Grove Park tour a week and a half ago. It begins in Sewell Park, which is on the south bank of the river just west of 17th Avenue. We eventually cross 17th into Grove Park, a subdivision created in 1921. On the west side of 17th Avenue, along something called the Lawrence Canal, obviously a man-made canal, I'm moving south to Northwest 7th Street, are these large openings in the Alitic Limestone Ridge that have been known historically for almost 100 years as the Indian Caves. We think they were natural solution holes that were enlarged by a developer, probably a guy named W.A. Williams, who was developing that area at the outset of the 1920s.
When you say natural solution holes?
Well, in the ridge itself, the Alitic Limestone is quite porous, and a lot of times there's like gaps in it. There's openings in it. And we believe that he came along and just widened all that. There's 2 caves, and there's about 4 or 5 openings to the caves, to the 2 caves. They're on the west side of the Lawrence Canal that runs perpendicular to the river, and it's running south of Northwest 7th Street. You could actually walk into that first cave. It's probably 6.5 feet in height. I've been in it with Bob Carr back in the mid-80s, and it's stunning. And any kid who grew up in the Miami of yesteryear near the river knew about the famous caves and explored those caves. The Miccosukees own the property where the caves are now.
Can we go there after 2 o'clock when we finish?
Yeah, I would love to. Would love to.
What about illicit trade on the river?
Well, there's been a lot of that. Drugs, aliens, smuggling. The river was under 3 jurisdictions between 2000 and 2003, federal, state, and local, because of both of that, alien smuggling and drugs. And of course, there's a precedent for it. During Prohibition, rum runners were bringing in booze all the time on the river and just dropping it off in burlap sacks at different parts of the river, as well as along Biscayne Bay.
Before we break, give us the breakdown on the 1985 the Miami River Cops scandal.
You had several rogue policemen, many of them hired during this panic after the Mauldin boat
cocaine
lift.
Cowboys.
Yeah, cocaine cowboys, Liberty City riots. We got to hire more police, and nobody checked their credentials. Many of these guys had criminal pasts. They're hired. These are rogue cops. They're ripping off drug dealers on the Miami River, among other places. And by the summer of 1985, it's rampant. And they pushed several of them into the river, canal technically. Three drowned. They couldn't swim. And that broke the case wide open in July of 1985.
So who pushed whom?
These cops who had ripped off Miami policing had ripped off these drug smugglers, cocaine smugglers.
To take their drugs.
Oh, okay.
And took their drugs, millions of dollars worth of drugs. And that broke open this whole case. 100 policemen are obviously reprimanded or incarcerated.
Indicted,
charged, whatever.
And some did jail time.
20 did prison time.
Mm. 20 did prison time.
Right.
We're talking with Dr. Paul George. And
we're
talking about his book that's been issued. He's compiled Along the Miami River. It has some great vintage photos and texts to go along with it. We'll take a short break and be back with Dr. George.
Once Miami was a river, flowed from the Sawgrass to the Gulf Stream blue. Wish that I had seen those rapids and heard the sound where Ferguson's mill went around. Ferguson built his mill, a pioneer. It was there that his corn and Coontie starch were ground. The rapids of Miami would make the big wheel sing as Ferguson's mill went around. La 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 la.
And we're listening to Ferguson's Mill by Grant Livingston. Thank you, Michael Stock, for that. A little bit of history. Did you know Ferguson's Mill?
Absolutely. That's where the rapids were. See, these Ferguson brothers put their machinery there. The rapids powered it, and they made what the Indians called Coontie or Compty starch.
Right.
Arrowroot powder.
You're listening to Dr. Paul George, a professor of history at Miami-Dade College, Wolfson, and an historian with History Miami. And
tell
the
us
name
more
of his
about
book.
This Coontie business. That was a cycad and was poisonous.
Right.
It
has
properly.
A lot of arsenic in it, but going back to the Tequestas, they learned that if you sort of pulverized
so
it,
made flour out of it.
They made flour to beef up their soups, make biscuits. They could use it in baking, of course, and it became the number one cash crop in Miami, South Florida through the end of the 19th century until civilization actually came here. And it also saved a lot of men in World War I who were poisoned with German mustard gas. They could keep that in their system.
Mm. How about the legacy of East Coast fisheries? I remember eating there years ago, but also it was originally a bordello?
It was a bordello built at the end of the 1910s, long gone today. Became by the 1930s on the part of the Schwartz family, became a fish market, and then it became a restaurant some years later. It was closed in 1999. One of the Schwartz brothers who ran it well passed away, and it just was run poorly after that. They had like 50 code violations. The city walked in one day in 99, late lunch, about 2 p.m., shut it down. You can imagine what the diners were thinking at that time.
Paul, what's the state of the river pollution-wise today?
Probably in better shape, despite the fact that it's a tremendous working river, fifth busiest port in the state of Florida, than it has been in a long time, because there was an $84 million dredge program that deepened the channel and cleaned up a lot of the pollution in the early 2000s and was finished about 4 years ago. And a lot of derelict vessels are long gone from the river today. So I think it's in better shape. There's a lot more attention being paid to it now than there has been before on the part of just people in general.
Didn't all this dredging cause any saltwater intrusion?
You know, I'm not sure. There's a salinity dam down at the end of the Navigable River, that's for sure. But it's something you don't want to drink. And you know, Senator Richard Stone, when he was running for Senate.
I remember that. I was there.
Wow. Well, he dove into it, first of all, and survived. And then he said, when I run again, I'm going to dive in until you indicate how clean it is. Well, he dove in, and he was hospitalized for weeks.
It was right behind the DuPont Plaza.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, speaking of that area, we can't talk about the river without mentioning Flagler's Royal Palm Hotel.
Right.
It had docks on the river.
It did have docks on the river, Joe. He really wanted to build that hotel at the confluence of the river and bay, and Julia Tuttle, who owned the property, said, you can't do it. It'll block my view of Biscayne Bay from my front porch. which was over at the entrance of the Hyatt Regency today. So he built it about a block up north of the river, and he built these beautiful gardens back there, and just on the edge of the gardens were the docks. The Vanderbilts, among others, would sometimes moor their yacht there, walk through the gardens to the rear of the Royal Palm Hotel.
Wow. Let's take a call or two. We've got Ira in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. I'm really pleased to be able to speak to you, and my question is about Tobacco Road. I am one of the people, I think, that helped create some of the myths and legends around Tobacco Road, and I was curious as to what was really true in terms of it being the oldest bar in Miami and whether Al Capone actually was there. The information that I've gotten is kind of the best that I'd be willing to say is that it's the oldest existing bar. I'd heard of a place called the Bowery, which was also on the river at about 17th Street. Anything you can tell me that would put some light on the subject, I'd appreciate.
Yeah, I'm happy to. The Tobacco Road is the oldest existing bar. That is, it began operating in 1912, but there were actually bars operating as far back as 1900 in downtown Miami, which would have really shaken up Julia Tuttle, who had been deceased at that point for 2 years.
Technically, the city was dry.
The city was dry from
so
the
North
beginning.
Miami, which is, would have started, say, like a 10th?
Yeah, about a little beyond 11th Street, yeah.
We are now was North Miami, and that was kind of the seedy part of town.
It was, the bordellos, the gambling, the bars, usually all in one. So Tobacco Road is the oldest operating bar in Miami, but again, there's older ones. Now, as far as Al Capone goes, he came here in the mid-1920s. He was trying to be John Q. Citizen initially. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 29 wiped out that image. He went away to three federal prisons in the 30s, came back here in 40 with tertiary syphilis. Al Capone couldn't do anything at that point. He died of a stroke in 1947. All the myths about Capone, he owned this, he was there, he was here, he was there, don't believe any of them. He was in Palm Island, and there was a funeral service in St. Pat's Catholic Church for him, and his body was shipped back in 1947 to Chicago.
He used to go to Hialeah Racetrack, though.
He was at Hialeah. But in terms of his ownership of this or that, he didn't need to own a Tobacco Road. He had enough money as it was.
We're speaking with Dr. Paul George. His book is Along the Miami River, if you want to join in the conversation. On Topical Currents, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or radio at WLRN.org. Radio at WLRN.org.
Paul, tell us about the Miami Country Club on the North Bank. And you, in the book, you talk about that there were Ku Klux Klan rallies.
Right. That was a jewel there of a club. It grew out of Flagler's nine-hole golf course about where that giant Winn-Dixie is, just east of Northwest 12th Avenue on 11th Street, right on the edge of Spring Garden. It grew out of that. By 1925, at the Miami Country Club, it covered the area where the Civic Center Hospital Complex is, west of 12th Avenue. Over to 14th Avenue.
It's like where Jackson is then.
Well, yeah, actually.
Civic Center, okay.
Yeah, but west of 12th.
All right.
Cedars, the Lebanon Hospital there, the VA Hospital's there, the Gerstein Building's there. That was all Country Club. Over to 14th Avenue from the river to 20th Street. And it flourished from the middle of the 1920s until, through eminent domain, the state and county took it over in the mid-1950s to make that Civic Center. There was not even a 12th Avenue moving north from 11th Street to 20th Street until then, because of the Country Club. The Ku Klux Klan had their initiation ceremonies out there some nights in the mid-1920s.
They used to parade on Flagler Street.
They did, with reckless abandon. Beginning in 1921, they announced they were in Miami. They came completely hooded all the way from head to toe in white, and they posed as a law and order organization. They would punish what they considered to be wrongdoers.
So you say that the mouth of the river is the single most important historical element in all of Southeast Florida. Tell us about more of the inhabitants.
Well, the procession of people at the mouth of the river, especially the North Bank, would include Tequesta Indians for, we think, as far back as 3,000 years, two slave plantations, two army forts, three Jesuit Spanish missions to the Indians, the home of Julia Tuttle, Henry Flagler's Great Royal Palm Hotel. It's just an unbeatable legacy there at the mouth of the river. And that's why it's so exciting to me that we've had several archaeological digs there.
And what years were the mission and the Jesuit?
1567, you had a Jesuit brother, Francisco Villarreal, there. 1568-70 was a second mission, Father Cedaño, and then a third in 1743 that lasted less than a year. Two Spanish Jesuit priests were there at that third mission.
And why were they so brief?
Great question. the first, the brother had all kinds of problems just dealing with his environment and the isolation, but he was able to take a small group of native Miamians to the great cathedral in Sevilla for their baptism. The second one ended in 1570, and we don't know why, because we don't have much of a record. The third ended because the native populations, which had dwindled so severely, were unhappy about seeing these Europeans back here. Their memories were long. Oral history told them that when they came 200 years before, that ushered in all of these problems. And so they left, I think, largely because they were unwanted here.
I read last week that some of the bridges really need repair. Give us a history of the bridges over the Miami River.
Well, the first bridge over the river was a non-draw bridge at today's Southwest 2nd Avenue, 1896. And then you have subsequent bridges, Miami Avenue, 1903. The Brickell Avenue Bridge, the initial one, doesn't come till 1930. 12th Avenue, 1928. First Street, 1929. Flagler was a toll bridge initially, known as the 12th Street Bridge in 1904, 1905. It would cost you a dime to walk over that bridge one way. And the city took it over. See, it was a private bridge on the part of the Tatum brothers developed in the area west of the river. City took it over in 1910, removed the tolls. But there's been three bridges at different times at Flagler. The latest is the 1966 bridge. And then as you go farther, the newest bridge in terms of a crossing is the 22nd Avenue in 1966. So you've had a very colorful history of bridges. 17th Avenue, 1929. So the 17th Avenue Bridge, Southwest 1st Street Bridge, are the two oldest in terms of they've been there forever. The Northwest 5th Street Bridge is just a few years old now. 12th Avenue is just a few years old. So yes, the 1st Street Bridge is going to be replaced.
What about the bridge by the Civic Center?
The 12th Avenue Bridge.
12th Avenue, right.
Initially 1928, and then just 3 or 4 years ago, the replacement bridge.
Do we have another call?
No, we don't.
We have no email. So tell us about some more of the colorful inhabitants of the North Bank.
Well, you've had so many interesting people there over time. We've mentioned the heavyweights like Henry Flagler and Julia Tuttle, and we've had Tequestas. And when we had an army fort there, people squatted there once the fort was vacated by the end of the 1850s. People like Ralph Monroe would go on to really help the found Coconut Grove, and the Peacock squatted there. And a guy named William English had a slave plantation there, and he was kind of a wheeler-dealer sort of a person. William Wagner set up shop as a sutler there. He was selling supplies to the military. You've had so many fascinating people on the north bank of the river.
And I was thinking it played a role in the Seminole Wars?
It did. You had Army Force there at the end of the 1830s on the north bank called Fort Dallas.
Okay.
And then during the Third Seminole War in the 1850s, it was activated.
Dr. Paul George, how about more information for those who want to go on the tour or perhaps go to your book signing?
We'd love to have them come. They can call 305-375-1621 for the river tour this Saturday between 9 and 11. The book signing is Saturday, the 18th of May, between 2 and 4 at History of Miami. Call the same number.
And you'll be back, I believe it's June 5th.
With the history quiz.
Serves, with another history quiz. We've only done about 45 of those.
And wait, there's also a website. It's citytours@historymiami.org.
There is.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Paul George.
Thanks, Dr. George.
Thank you, both of you. Thanks.
Food and Dining is next. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And it's time now for our food and dining segments. As usual, we're joined by my friend, chef, author, syndicated columnist, Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, the Miami Heat certainly evened the Chicago playoff series last night. And there will be a Game 5 in Miami against the Bulls. Perhaps that'll be the clincher. Suppose you have an idea about amenities at the AAA, huh?
I suppose I do. Well, it's heat fever in Miami. They more than did their job last night. It's an exciting time. And the American Airlines Arena is lit up. But as you mentioned, there's other things there. There's some exciting food there, and it's more than just hot dogs and pizza. And here to tell us about the new food scene and activities is Richard Post. He's the Hyde American Airlines Arena General Manager. Welcome, Richard Post.
Hey, guys. How you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
I understand you had a wild night last night.
Yes, it was quite a game, quite a game.
Yes. Well, of course, coming up this weekend, we have Mother's Day. And we have an exciting hot, white hot champagne here with us. And it has a white hot heat connection. And more on that to come. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions about the arena or anything you would like to ask us about it? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. And do we have email?
We do. It's radio at WLRN.org, radio at WLRN.org. Where's Fred?
Where's Fred? We're about to
Fred's
see.
Here.
Fred, you're going to miss today.
Fred's white hot up there.
I am. It's 80 degrees here.
Oh, really? Fred Tasker is joining us by Skype. And as you all know, he writes the Wine Suggestion for my Dinner Minutes column that you can read in today's Miami Herald. And you can also read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, celebrating Mother's Day?
Oh, always celebrate Mother's Day. Got some nice wines for that, too.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go to Richard Post. Hyde American Airlines Arena. What is this?
Well, Hyde American Airlines Arena is a very unique place that we've decided to build inside the Miami Heat Arena. It offers something very unique that is not offered anywhere else in the arena. It's a place where you can go watch the game. You can have different type of food that's not served anywhere else in the arena. We have sushi rolls, we have steak, we have chicken. You can relax before the game, watch the game on one of our TVs. You can eat. Then you can go back to the game. Then you can also come back for an after party.
I bet it's very inexpensive, too.
Oh, I bet. How do you get in there? Do you need a special entry? Is there special admission, or can you just...
Yes, there's a $50 cover. The people who have guaranteed access...
Per person.
Yes, $50 per person. The people who have guaranteed access sit actually on the court, what we like to call feet on wood. Otherwise, you can check in at one of our host stands at section 114, and you can pay your $50 cover, and then you're escorted down the VIP entrance that gets you into Hyde. If you do not have a game ticket, you can also come in, pay $50, and come in through the P2 parking garage entrance, and you can just hang out, eat, enjoy the game, you know, feeling part of the game without having to buy an actual game ticket.
Oh, you don't need a Heat ticket to go to Hyde?
No, you do not. It's what we call it a Hyde-only ticket. It's $50. It gets you access into Hyde, so you can feel like you're part of, you know, part of the Heat, part of watching the game, but you actually don't have to have a ticket.
Oh,
so you basically
great.
Just come in.
Are you saying
in.
That you could get on the floor for $50 without buying an additional ticket?
No.
You had me worried for a minute there.
No, it actually only guarantees you entrance into the actual Hyde.
Hyde is a kind of nightclub, come restaurant, come fun place.
Hyde.
Yes, at the arena, and there is a separate entrance. So if you don't have a ticket and you can't get into the arena itself, you can still get into Hyde through going through the parking lot.
Yeah, the parking lot entrance is our own entrance.
Last night during the playoffs, is it standing room only there? Or?
It was quite full, yeah. All tables were sold out. Everybody was on edge. You know, it was a massive blowout, so you know everybody really came down to celebrate. After the game, it turns into a full-blown nightclub. We have world-famous DJ Irie. He hosts and spends throughout the night. We have cryo, confetti, and it's
a... I had to ask him. We had cryo. Do you know what cryo is?
No.
Well, tell us what cryo is, because he sent me a picture of this.
Cryo is it's a CO2 machine that shoots CO2 into the crowd, and it's more of like a cool fog that we shoot onto the people, and it's quite a fun experience.
Hmm.
It didn't really, but it doesn't cool down the crowd.
I guess not. So how late are you open?
We have a 4 a.m. license, depending on how late the game goes, typically about 2.5-3 hours after the game.
So it's kind of an upscale sports bar, or we can't even call it a sports bar.
I like to call it a sports club. I like to stay away from the bar word. We're trying to stay in a upscale, very unique place. We're trying to create something new that is nowhere else in the world.
Briefly, what's your background and where are you from?
I was born and raised in Miami, and I lived in Los Angeles for 8 years, and then I worked in Las Vegas for 3 years, and then it brought me back to Miami now.
That's where he got the nightclub part.
Right.
In Las Vegas. Now, he mentioned that we have food that's different from any other food, and we've got the food here. And I want to tell you, I tasted some of it. And you have special food for the Heat game, so tell us what you've got.
Yes, like I said, we offer a variety of things that's not really offered anywhere else in the arena, as we're trying to be separate.
Because I have to say, some people, someone emailed me to say that he's not quite happy with the food at the arena and the service isn't so great. So tell us about the food you've got.
Well, like I said, I can't attest to what the arena has, but I do can say that at Hyatt American Airlines Arena, the food is very good, the service is good. We have special sushi rolls, we have Wagyu steak, yuzu chicken, ceviches. We have two specialty rolls that are designed for the Miami Heat, the Heat Roll, the White Hot Roll. The Heat Roll is one of our favorites in the venue.
So you've got a Heat Roll, and tell us what's in it, because I think there's something interesting here.
The Heat Roll is a spicy tuna roll with rock shrimp tempura on top with red chilies.
It's like a sushi roll.
It's a sushi roll.
It's a sushi roll. And then you've got the rock shrimp on top. And then you've got a hot spicy sauce on that?
Yes.
All right. So that's white hot heat sauce. And what was the other one you were talking about?
That is the Heat Roll. And the other one is the White Hot Roll, which is a spicy California roll with baked scallops on top with a dynamite white creamy sauce on top.
Does Pat Riley ever hang out there?
Pat Riley does come through. He's a very superstitious man. And he comes through every game, gives me a high five, and then at the halftime, he'll go back through. So, yes, he comes through every single game.
Talk about superstition. Since this is radio, you can't see Richard Post, but he's growing a beard. What's the superstition there?
Well, I made it a vow to myself and a couple of the guys in the office that I would not shave until we brought home a trophy.
Okay.
All right.
So,
Fred, guess what we're going to do?
We mentioned earlier.
You're going to eat all that food and drink all that bubbly, and I'm going to sit here and be jealous.
Okay, so what he's doing is we've got this Moët Chandon Ice Imperial bottle here, and he's putting ice in some. We've got white goblets, and go ahead, pop that cork there.
But they don't look like traditional champagne glasses.
No.
Whoa! There we go. Okay.
Wow, did you hurt anybody?
Okay, Fred, tell us about this this Ice Imperial.
This is pretty interesting. Moët and Chandon, the French champagne people, have created something that almost seems specifically designed for the Hyde Club. It is a champagne that is made to be served over ice. Now, this might seem like heresy for the company that also makes Dom Pérignon, but Moët's chief winemaker, Benoit Gouès, in an interview on YouTube, explained it this way. Moët noticed that people drank champagne mostly in cold weather in the holiday season, but cut back in the summer. In hot weather, they seemed to want something lighter and more refreshing and more casual. So Moët created a bubbly specifically for ice cubes. It's made mostly of Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier grapes, which are both red grapes, for additional power and structure and fruitiness. They make it a little sweeter than regular Brut champagnes and a little higher in acid.
Why is it sweeter, Fred?
I'm sorry?
Why is it sweeter?
Well, all of these things together make it what they call denser, which means that it has the ability to stand up to ice. Even Gouès of Moët agrees that regular champagne, if you put it over ice, would get thin and watery and wimpy and that sort of thing. So what you're supposed to do, and I guess what you're doing there, is
we sure
to
are. Let me just tell you, Fred.
Yeah, Linda's going at it here.
You're really missing this, Fred.
I am missing it very much. And then you drop in precisely 3 ice cubes, no more. And you're supposed to drink it in the daytime, which I guess the Hyde Club kind of breaks that rule. But you're supposed to drink it at the beach, on the yacht, around the pool, according to the Moët publicity. And when the sun goes down, you're supposed to go back to Moët's regular champagnes with dinner.
Well, this gets complicated.
It does. This is not easy stuff, Joe. But anyway, I haven't had a chance to try it, so you've got it popped open. Take a sip and tell us what you think.
Well, it's really very—it's very cool. It's bubbly,
but
it's
sweeter.
It's sweet. Yeah. It is sweeter. It's kind of a nice thing for Mom for Mother's Day, I think.
Normally, wouldn't think about ice cubes and champagne, but. Yeah, it works.
No, but so I don't know, Fred, are we supposed to, so we don't have to put the champagne on ice? We just put it...
Well, it wouldn't hurt. I would always put champagne on ice beforehand so it doesn't melt the ice chill it down to 50, 60 degrees before you do it, just to keep it from melting the ice too much. But, and now I understand this costs about $60 or $70, right?
Right. I think so. It depends on where you're buying it. There's also, we're going to break in a minute, but there's a special connection with the Heat, the Heat team. What is it? It's these.
Due to the white bottle, the white gold, you know, the gold with the trophy, the white bottle, it is actually the official champagne of the Miami Heat playoffs. So it's a perfect fit for what we're targeting inside of Hyde Club. It's a white bottle. That way everything can be white themed throughout the arena.
Okay. So you mean when they pour it over each other's heads this year, it's going to be...
knock on wood. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
You just don't want to stain your jersey if you pour it over your head.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking with Hyde American Airlines Arena General Manager, Richard Post. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and our guest is Richard Post. He's the general manager of Hyde American Airlines Arena. He's been telling us about the new food choices at the arena at Hyde, and we've been toasting the Miami Heat with this Ice Imperial Moet Chandon champagne. We've really been enjoying ourselves.
Have you ever had the Birdman come in after the game?
No, they don't really come in
the
after.
The team doesn't come in. Well, as many of you know, one of my latest books is Flavors of the Florida Keys. And if you're thinking of planning a trip to Key West, come and join me on a special four-day cruise from Miami to Key West. That's going to be next January 30th, 2014. We're going to be going on the Celebrity Constellation. I'm going to be giving cooking demonstrations, and I'm going to take you around Key West.
I'm marking my calendar right now for January.
Hey, my daughter and her fiance took Linda's book down to the Keys, and they found some wonderful restaurants, so I can vouch for that.
Okay. Thank you, Fred. Well, for more information, you can call Kendall Lakes Travel or just email me, linda@dinnerinminutes.com. Okay, so now, Dinner in Minutes, if you're going to have your Dinner in Minutes at home for Mother's Day. Some people prefer to stay home rather than go out, but they don't want the fuss. This is a no-fuss roasted chicken pasta salad. There's no mess to clean up. It uses only one pot, and it won't heat up your kitchen. So the basis is you buy a chicken, a roasted chicken, a rotisserie chicken, and you mix some mayonnaise, some curry powder, and I bought some mango chutney. I mixed all that together. Mm-hmm. I tossed it with the chicken. And I boiled some pasta. That's where the pot comes in. You have to boil the pasta, you drain it, and you toss that with the chicken, and you serve the salad on top of some lettuce leaves, put some sliced scallions on top, put some tomatoes around it, and that recipe and photo is in today's Miami Herald. And if you want another quick chicken recipe for Mother's Day, there's a chicken parmesan with fresh basil linguine. It's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, are we still drinking here?
Oh, we're always still drinking here.
I knew that.
In fact, speaking of champagne, there's actually good news in the bubbly business, or potentially anyway. It was actually years ago that medical researchers concluded that champagne and sparkling wines have antioxidants that are good for your heart, and some people claim it's even as good for you as red wine.
Oh, is that
but
right?
Now,
that's interesting.
Good news.
Yeah.
Yeah, now researchers at Reading University in the UK say they believe champagne might help dementia and Alzheimer's. So this seems to be good for
anything. Where did you find this out, Fred?
He's been digging to get stuff on.
I have been digging, yes. This is my life.
Anything to support your bubbly, right?
Well, this works at least with rats. I don't know about humans yet. They took a group of rats and snuck champagne into the food of half of them and left the other half high and dry. And over a six-week period, they had the rats run mazes, and the rats on champagne had a 70% success rate, while the teetotaling rats had only a 50% success rate.
Oh, it sounds good.
Yeah, very hopeful. But now the researchers are about to repeat the study on a group of elderly humans, and no, I don't know how you can apply to be in that study.
Why elderly humans?
Well, that's when dementia and Alzheimer's become important.
Oh, all right. I thought maybe before.
No elderly humans around here.
Yeah, we don't have any. Present company is accepted, of course. In any case, they speculate that humans over 40 would be well off to drink two or three glasses of champagne per week and see if it helps you to run the mazes of life.
Very good.
Bonnie, you had a question?
I have a question for Richard. We were talking about your superstition and growing your beard until we take home a trophy, the Miami Heat.
Yes.
I was just wondering, I mean, it begs the question, if we don't take home the trophy?
I could turn into a Duck Dynasty lookalike.
You look like one of the Oak Ridge boys.
You're just going to keep letting it grow until we get it?
Hey, yeah, it's a vow. You know, I have faith in my team. And
you're pretty confident.
That, we'll be okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Richard, hang in there. We guys with beards have got to hang together.
All right. So now we've been talking, if you've just joined us, about Hyde American Airlines Arena. Now, this is a sports bar, but tell us again. This is not kind
it's
of.
It's not a bar. It's a sports club.
A club. But I think it's much more of a club than sports. Tell us some of the exciting things that have happened there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ones that you can talk about on National Public Radio.
Right.
got something better than that?
Like I said, it turns into a full-blown nightclub afterwards. You know, it's a very unique place. We're creating something. Every day is a learning experience for us.
There's dancing.
Dancing, full bottle service. There's, like I said, the confetti, the bar. We have a little guy that's kind of the Hyde mascot. He'll dress up and he'll make it fun for us. They'll bring out the bottles.
What does he dress up in?
He'll dress up in Superman costumes and all kind of stuff to make it fun. And it's really a party. I mean,
that's after the game.
After the game.
That's after we win.
After we win.
And yeah. If we don't win?
If we don't win, you'd be surprised. People are still there to party. I mean, if you've ever been there, it takes you about an hour and a half, 2 hours to leave due to the traffic delays. So a lot of people will funnel in there. They'll
so you beat traffic.
Yeah, you hang out, have a few drinks, party, listen to the music, let the traffic die down, and then, you know, go.
So if we wanted to make a reservation, we phone the club? How do we do that?
There is a number, 855-777-HYDE, or you can send an email to VIP@HydeAAArena.com.
So and anybody, even if you don't have a ticket now, anybody can pay the cover charge.
Pay the cover charge, yes. Yeah.
I suspect you might be full for Friday night.
Yeah.
It fills up pretty quick due to the playoffs. You know, the biggest thing is it's a $50 cover, but if you have a larger group, it's better to buy the table. We sell the table experience. It's a full night experience. So you can start the table. You can get there with your group. If you have five or six people, $50, that's $300 right there. So we start the tables at about $1,000, and that gets you the food and beverage minimum. You can have dinner, go to the game, come back at halftime, and then enjoy your table after the game.
Well, put me down for two tables.
Got it.
We'll bring the whole crew.
But now it's open even after for other events. It's not.
We're
just
open for all home games. We're doing away viewing parties, so all the away games. We're
so
open
even
for
when they're away, you're open. Uh-huh.
Yes, we have a 20-foot TV with the sound and
20-foot?
Oh. Yeah.
I thought you said 8, Linda.
I thought it was 8.
20. And we have 15 other 40-inch TVs that we're going to be showing the TV, the game. And then we also have, we're open during concerts. So all concerts, and then we're available for private buyouts.
What's the website again?
It's HydeAAArena.com.
All right. Well, that sounds very exciting. We want to all root for the Heat coming up. Friday night's the next game.
Yes, I'll be happy to come back and you guys can shave my beard.
All right.
I think I'll pass on that.
It's been a very tasty week. Richard Post, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And for the ultra delicious food. Hyde American Airlines Arena is located at the arena. A fun place, great vibe, good food, and of course, great basketball. Bonnie Berman and Joe Cooper, great to be with you.
Thank
you. And the
you.
Recipes
you
at dinnerandminutes.com, right?
Absolutely.
The
easy,
chicken.
Quick recipes for
curry.
Mother's Day. Yes. And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Next week, we'll be talking with Miami Herald. Next week, we're going to be talking about healthy, good food for us. That's okay. What we'll be talking about. Anyway, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Happy Mother's Day, Linda, Bonnie, Caroline. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. We also have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. We return Monday with the author of Two Presidents Are Better Than One, The Case for a Bipartisan Executive Branch. And in all 1960s calendar, on this day in 1960, 53 years ago, the FDA approves Enovid, the first oral contraceptive. And on this day in 1961, 52 years ago, FCC Chairman Newton Minow gives a speech castigating TV networks for insipid programming. He challenged executives to sit through an entire day of their, quote, vast wasteland. One more while we shift into the rope-a-dope. Excuse me. On this day, 1967, 46 years ago, Muhammad Ali is indicted by a federal grand jury for refusing army induction, and the WBA takes away his heavyweight championship title. His conviction was overturned by a Supreme Court ruling, and he regained the title in The Rumble in the Jungle. George Foreman. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from Newton Minow, whose FCC tenure also sparked the movement which created PBS and NPR. Quote, when television is good, nothing is better. When it's bad, nothing is worse. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.